stay tuned for The Lynn Show, coming up in just a few seconds. Today, I'm going to continue to talk about past dangers and how they stop us from doing what we want to do. In today's show, I'm going to talk about the past danger of feelings. And continuing my Anatomy of an Artist interviews, I'm going to play the couple interview with actress, philanthropist Carolyn Michael and her director, theater manager, husband, Howard Millman. That's coming up right now. Welcome to The Lynn Show. If you're first tuning in, welcome, welcome, welcome. If you're a returning listener, I'm really happy to have you here. I'm going to recap a little bit of what I've been doing and then tell you what I'm going to do in this show. I've been talking about the things that get between us and what we want to do in our lives. And in the last few shows, I've been talking about the concept of danger and how anticipating, even if unconsciously, anticipating some kind of danger will stop us from doing things that we might ordinarily really want to do, maybe even have to do. And I've been making the point that this danger that we're anticipating, we may not be aware of it, because as a culture, we're so oriented toward the goal. We're so goal-focused that we focus all our attention on what we want to happen. And when it doesn't happen, we may yell at ourselves, we may try harder, we may beat ourselves up or criticize ourselves or try and trick ourselves. There are lots of things we'll do, but we don't look at the why it's not happening. We're not a why-centered kind of culture. We're a when and show me the money kind of culture. So we don't look for the obstacle that's getting in our way, and because we don't look for it, we rarely know what it is. So we're in this odd dilemma that we want this thing, we keep trying, we don't get it, and we can't look for the why, so then we just look at ourselves and think bad things about ourselves. We think we're lazy, or we're apathetic, or we're self-destructive, or we're sabotaging. We have all these words to describe why we haven't done what we wanted to do, or stopped doing something we wanted to stop doing. I don't believe human beings are self-destructive. If you've heard the show before, you've heard me say this, and you will hear me say it again and again. I believe that we are self-protective, and that we're all doing the best we can. And that when we seem to be acting against what we imagine to be our best interests, it's because there's something we don't see that would be detrimental to us. And one of the things that we quite often don't see is a danger. In the last few shows, I talked about catastrophic expectations. I talked about future dangers, those being things that we've never done before, and they just bring the danger of the unknown. And for the last two or three shows, I think I've been talking about past dangers. And what that means is things that you did, usually early in your life, that had a bad consequence. It didn't work out well. If what you want to do in the present resembles even what you did in the past that didn't work out well, your unconscious has remembered that, and it's saying, whoa, that's not a good place to go. In the last show, I talked about a young woman whose early experiences with an abusive father stopped her from being able to risk romance later in her life. Oh, and maybe this is a good time to say that the early shows, which I refer to because everything I talk about is building on something that I talked about before. So everything I talk about that's in an earlier show, you can hear most of them on my website. Some of them we're having trouble getting up there, but you can hear most of them. And there are blurbs next. It says new podcasts. And if you click on new podcast, my website is thelynnshow.com, thelynnshow, that's one word. And you have to put the E in at the end of my name because there's another The Lynn Show. And I don't know what she does there, but you won't get my podcast. So if you're looking to hear an earlier show, either because you're interested in them or because I have referred to something like catastrophic expectations or future danger or cover story, which I'm going to talk about again, and which I talked about last week, or I didn't really talk about it, I sort of alluded to because I talked about it at length in an earlier show, you can hear those shows earlier on the podcast. Okay, all right. So today I'm going to continue to talk about dangers, and the danger I'm going to talk about specifically today is the danger of feeling. In the last show, some of what I talked about had to do with cover story, and that has to do with exposing aspects of ourselves which we would prefer to keep hidden. But it's not only the exposure of characteristics of ourself that gets us into trouble or that we're unwilling to show. We are quite often unwilling to feel certain feelings. Expressing certain feelings can be a very, very potent past danger, and one that forces many, many people to avoid making changes that they might otherwise really want to make in their lives. The spontaneous expression of emotion is often taboo. A lot of us feel shy or embarrassed about the spontaneous expression of joy or sadness or anger, depending on what you learned was appropriate or acceptable when you were a child. And if you learned that outbursts of anger brought punishment, well, then you keep a tight rein on that, even when anger would be appropriate. This is a culture that is really, well, not that open to the spontaneous expression of what we like to think of as the negative emotions. So, you know, we had the Grammy Award-winning song, Don't Worry, Be Happy. And before that, we had Melissa Manchester telling us all, don't cry out loud, just keep it inside and learn how to hide your feelings. Well, you could hardly have a better mantra. That's not what I mean, really. I can't think of what this word is. Theme song. You can hardly have a better theme song for the denial of emotion than don't cry out loud, just keep it inside, learn how to hide your feelings. Thank you, Melissa, for putting it in words. We all tell each other to have a nice day. When anybody asks you how you are, it's hard to resist saying I'm fine. It's such a reflex. I was at a doctor's office once. I went in, I had the flu. And the doctor said, how are you? And I said, oh, I'm awful. And he said, you would be surprised how many people come in here feeling really dreadful. And when I ask them how they are, they say they're fine. You can't help it. Your mouth just says it, right? Also, we've decided what other people are going to say before they say it. So an old friend of mine called me and said, well, what's going on? And I said, oh, well, it was my birthday. And he said, well, did you have a good time? And I said, no. And he said, that's good. I wasn't supposed to say no. I was supposed to say yes. I had a great time. Yada-da-da-da, right? We're just so programmed to that, and that is all because the spontaneous expression of emotion for most of us, much of the time, is taboo. So ask yourself, are there certain emotions that you are reluctant to express? Or forget express, even feel. Are you embarrassed by, or annoyed at, or judgmental about outbursts of anger or fear? Or are you uncomfortable when people cry? That is when they do it or when you do it? If so, then simply feeling may be one of your past dangers. You possess all of the possible emotions. Whether you recognize and express them or hide and deny them, you can feel joy, sadness, rage, contentment, fear, grief, despair, delight. Whatever human beings are capable of feeling, you are capable of feeling. You may have a cover story that says, oh, I just never get angry. But this only means that early in your life, when you expressed your anger, something happened that hurt or embarrassed or frightened you, and in self-defense, you placed that anger under cover. You promised yourself that you'd never expose it again, and you created a cover story that just left it out. The more painful the early experience, the more powerful your personal taboo against repeating it. This, of course, would be true of sadness. If you cried and your parent, made fun of you, that would make sadness too dangerous an emotion. I had a client once who came from a very strictly religious family, and for them, joy was the devil. And so any spontaneous expression of happiness or giddiness or joy was roundly discouraged. And this poor thing was just struggling to have the smallest amount of enjoyment in her life. Anything that looked like it was going to bring her pleasure really had to be avoided. And that's what past dangers means. That something that happened earlier in your life, and in the case of what we're talking about now, that caused a feeling that brought some response that you don't want to have again. So in the present and in the future, if you don't find this, anything that threatens to trigger that emotion will have to be avoided. So you can see that if you have to avoid certain emotions, you'll have to avoid certain situations. For example, if you cannot bear to feel fear, then you probably shy away from anything that's remotely scary. If anger embarrasses you, then confrontation may be out of the question. The circumstance of the present doesn't have to duplicate the circumstance of the past. All it has to do is trigger it in order for it to be a past danger that gets in the way of something that you want to do. Angie was a client of mine, and she came to me to talk about writer's block. She needed to work on an article about a depressed teenager. Angie had always been a very prolific writer. She got an assignment and went right to it, and she never had any trouble developing story ideas, but she just could not make herself work on this article. In the therapy session, we talked about everything, and then finally we got around to talking about Angie's early life, and in a kind of random way, she began to talk about her mother's death when she was 14, and then, to her amazement, she started to cry uncontrollably. She was astonished. She said, "I didn't think this still hurt me. I never think about it anymore." After her mother died, Angie went to live with her grandparents. They were kind, but they were unable to comfort her. She was a frightened and confused teenager, and she found that the only way to deal with her feelings was to bury her grief and sorrow. Consciously, she believed that she'd dealt with it. Now, this assignment, in which she had to probe the feelings of a depressed teenager, threatened to unearth all of that terrible pain and suffering, and she simply couldn't go there. Fear of experiencing the hurtful feelings that she had had to deny as a child stopped her cold. When she saw the connection between what she had experienced as a child and the work that she was now wanting to do, she began to use her therapy sessions to express the grief that she had long denied. Once this was done and she was free of that grief, the writer's block disappeared, and the article that she wrote was touching and incredibly real. Like Angie, most of us believe that emotions that we don't experience go away. They melt or they evaporate. We don't actually think that through, but we're sure that they're not there anymore. Like Angie, she thought that she didn't feel that anymore. But it isn't true. Feelings that you don't fully express don't go away. They just go undercover. And of course, undercover is another concept that I explain in detail in an earlier show. So you've got these feelings undercover. They are stored in a box, on a shelf, in the back of your psyche. And every time you find yourself in a situation which requires an emotion that you don't have permission to feel, it gets added to the collection. I knew a man once who had no permission to feel either sadness or fear. He could feel anger, and he could feel a certain amount of pleasure, but fear and sadness were completely unacceptable to him. And he learned really young that every time he was in danger of feeling fear or sadness, his mind thought of a joke, and he would tell the joke, and everybody would laugh, including him. And that would diffuse the situation in which the fear or the sadness was threatening him. Well, when he figured that out, he thought to himself, well, I'll just stop that. You know, when I feel sadness or fear creeping in and I have the impulse to tell the joke, I just won't tell it. And then came a moment when he was actually able to recognize that what he was beginning to feel was sadness. And he thought, well, I won't tell a joke. But his body laughed anyway. It was completely inappropriate, but he understood what was happening. The reflex to avoid the sadness was so strong, and his body was so trained, that it laughed without benefit of the joke. I'm going to talk in a later show about the mind-body connection. But for now, suffice it to say, feelings simply don't go away. That every time life gives you an experience that demands an emotion which you have decided you shouldn't feel, remember, it's added to the collection, and it remains a part of you. Also, whether you realize it or not, situations that potentially trigger emotions you are wanting to avoid are situations you're going to avoid. You'll stay away from situations. So there'll be things that you can't do, places you can't go, experiences you can't have, because your unconscious knows that there's the threat that an unacceptable emotion might be there. Well, you can tell from what I'm saying that I don't think emotions are our enemies. Rather, I think they're our allies. Emotions are neither good nor bad. They're just an essential part of being a human being. Just as sweating releases toxins from the body, so feelings release stress from the psyche. Exercise generates sweat. Living generates feelings. Scary events trigger fear. Heartbreaking events trigger sadness. And joyful events trigger happiness. We wouldn't ask a jogger not to sweat or a person with a full bladder not to urinate, but we regularly ask ourselves and others not to feel. Well, that's a lot of talking, and I think it's enough for now. It's been my experience that this material, which really seems pretty easily understandable to me, really is difficult to integrate. So I don't like to give too much of it at a time, and I think this is enough for now. I'm going to remind you that in this month's shows, I've been asking you to vote on whether I should continue to use You Really Can as the opening song and I Won't Go With a Whimper as the closing song, or switch them, or, assuming that you know any of the other songs in my CD, if there's a song you think would be better to use either at the beginning or the end of the show. And I'm going to play another song from the CD. I haven't done that in a very long time, but I'm going to play a song called Behind the Woman, There's a Child. I'm going to play that today because, as you no doubt can see, it's perfectly appropriate to what I'm talking about. I'm talking about the child who is the receptacle. Ugh, terrible, terrible choice of words, Lynn. The child who carries all of our early experiences, all of our unexpressed emotions. That's, of course, who was crying in my office when Angie broke down. The child who had this experience, who was unable to express the emotion because it was too big, too scary, and there was nobody there to make it all right, to say that it was all right. So the child carries that, and we each carry a child inside of us. So I'm going to play Behind the Woman, and then after that, I'm going to play the interview with Carolyn Michael, who is a brilliant actress and a philanthropist, and her husband, director and theater manager, Howard Millman. If you were listening a few weeks ago, you heard me play the interviews with each one of them. If you haven't listened before, I'm doing a series of interviews called Anatomy of an Artist. I'm interviewing people who make their living, have made their livings with their creativity. And I've been lucky enough to have found several couples who make their living with creativity, both of them. And I've been interviewing him and her and them. In earlier shows, I've been able to play his and hers, but not theirs. There's just not enough time. And so now I've been playing the couple interviews. And today I'm going to air the interview with Carolyn and Howard. But before I do that, I'm going to play Behind the Woman, and here it is now.
I can work the whole damn day, way into the night, look like make out all right, and although I can fool you with my grown-up woman style, a child. Behind the woman, there's a child. The surface is calm, the current is wild. If you wanna have me around a while, love the woman and the child. I may keep her tucked away. She don't like to fight, and though she plays hide and seek today, she'll come out tonight. 'Cause just like there are often tears behind the brightest smile.
Behind the woman, there's a child. Behind each and every one of us, underneath each and every one of us, there is a child, carrying whatever we were unable to sufficiently express when we experienced it. Some of us are unfortunately carrying huge boxes of accumulated unpleasant feelings that there was just no safe way to express when they were first experienced. But all of us are carrying something. And the extent to which we're carrying that unopened box is the extent to which there are things in our present that we are unable to risk, unable to reach for, unable to experience. I was remembering while I was listening to this song that I actually wrote that song for a client. She was sitting across from me, very, very straight, very, very together, very, very controlled. She was in executive suit, heels, everything. We were talking about her childhood, and she was describing some pretty unpleasant stuff, but it wasn't showing. And rather spontaneously, I handed her a stuffed animal. And when she grasped it, her entire body changed. She turned right into that little girl in front of my eyes. And of course, she started to weep. It wasn't until many years later when I was singing this song that I realized that I had not only written it for her. And maybe I wrote it for you too. The next voices you hear are going to be Carolyn Michael and Howard Millman. I am embarrassed and really unhappy to admit that I lost part of this interview. And so this interview begins in the middle. What you'll hear is Howard talking about how well they work together. They've worked together many, many times. He's directed her quite often. And he's describing how well he knows her and how easily he can read her. Unfortunately, it's going to start there, and what you're going to miss is the beginning where I introduce them and talk about them a little bit. So you're not going to have any of that. And also, more importantly, in the piece that I lost, Carolyn is describing how she quite often wakes up in the middle of the night when she's in production and she thinks, I'm going to suck in this play. In the interview, several times, we make reference to that. But you will not have heard the piece where she's describing it. So I wanted to let you know, I'm terribly embarrassed and sorry that you're going to miss it, because everything that they talk about is really interesting and funny and delightful. But that's not a good reason not to play the rest of the interview. So here, picking up in the middle, are Howard and Carolyn.
We work very well together. I can read her eyes when I see that she's not happy with a suggestion I've given her. I can read her eyes when I see she's ecstatic with a suggestion I've given her. Yeah. I can read her eyes when I see she's not sure that what I've given her is the right thing. The difference between us is when we come home, because I want to shut it all down, and she doesn't.
I still process when I'm home.
So I want to ask about that, two things about that. One, is it different for you? I mean, I'm assuming that you used to get up in the middle of the night and say to yourself, I'm going to suck in this play. Mm-hmm. And now, when you get up and you say, I'm going to suck in this play, there is someone else there who you either expect something from or you don't. I'm not sure. Is it different?
That's an interesting question.
That is an interesting question. Yes, I guess it is different because I get to say it and have somebody to say it to in the middle of the night.
You got to say it out loud.
I used to have to call. Yeah, I get to say it out loud. I used to have to call California. They're the only ones awake in the middle of the night.
No. So did you?
What?
Call people?
I did, but I didn't. I don't think I ever said I'm going to suck in this play. I think I would just call to
chat.
To chat, and that would be a way to distract me from my own personal self-doubt.
Yeah, but that's different than saying to somebody that you expect to care for you, you know, I'm going to suck in this play.
That's true.
You know, there's an expectation or maybe not an expectation, but the comfort of knowing that there's somebody else who cares also, even if he says go to sleep.
That's true.
Yeah.
That's true.
We were talking earlier about the fact that you waited a long time to get married.
Yes, I did.
So this is an extension of that question. Is your relationship to your work different? Because there's now somebody who shares that with you.
My relationship to my work is different because I have a fuller life now. Mm-hmm. And so my relationship to my work is different. I've also worked so much and that have done it that much more that my relationship to my work is different as well.
Do you mean you're working more now than you did before, or you worked more before than you are now?
I've worked a lot all the time.
Yeah.
I've worked a lot all the time.
I think she's working with more confidence now that she's done it so much.
Ah. Yeah.
That's what I think.
And do you bounce? You're not always working with Howard, so do you talk to him about the other work you're doing?
Yes.
Yes,
and you know what I do?
Mm-hmm.
I say, uh-huh.
Yeah, I was going to say, he'd rather I didn't, but I do.
She has to air it. All women have to air it, you know. I have finally learned that all the men have to do is say, oh, uh-huh.
Well, that brings me actually to a question that's been forming in my mind. You said that you were married before and you were married to a teacher.
I was actually married to a singer, an actress, and a teacher, and yeah, and she did a lot of things.
Oh, not four different women?
No.
No, one. Oh, okay, so, because I was going to ask.
She was in the arts.
She was?
Yeah.
Okay, so so then you are used to being in relationship with a woman who is using herself in a creative way.
Yes, the difference is she never shared with me her anxieties the way she does.
And that's
a very good thing. It's a very good thing that she shares her anxieties.
Yes, even if you're just a sounding board for it.
Exactly right,
yes.
Exactly right. And because she never shared her anxieties, it finally forced her away from it because she couldn't deal with it.
Yes, that's an interesting dilemma. Yeah. And I do think that
the potential for comforting each other. I mean, let's face it, the arts is an unstable thing. Mm-hmm. You know, you may or you may not have work, you may or you may not do good work, you may or may not be appreciated for the work you do, however good it is. You're always at the mercy of something outside yourself. I mean, there's just all of these places that are in which you're vulnerable. And so to have a spouse who understands that, it seems to me, is potentially incredibly comforting and supportive, but not all couples who are in the arts can do that for each other.
Well, that's true. I think it's important that we also have, we don't compete with each other.
Yes.
So there is that issue that we can be totally supportive of each other. There is no competition. And it's later in our lives,
yeah,
too. So we're not young. So you bring to your work, your creative work, and your relationship a different perspective, because you're in a different part of your life and you've just lived that many more years where you have accumulated experience that can bring you to this place. No matter what my accumulated experience is, I always wake up at midnight and go, I'm going to suck in this play. So there seems to be a point where my accumulated experience has no impact.
Fails you.
On my
role. You know, it's the nature of the beast. If I've directed a play before, I don't go into the first rehearsal with the apprehensions that I have when I direct a play that I've not done before.
Mm-hmm.
And I don't care how many years it's been. I walk into rehearsal the first day and I say to myself very quietly, today they're going to find me out.
Yeah, it's the same thing.
You know, today they're going to find me out. Yeah. I don't know what the hell I'm doing.
It's the proverbial artist facing the blank canvas.
Do you know the story of Frank Capra, that he's on his way in the cab to present It's a Wonderful Life to James Stewart? And he says to himself, and I heard him say this, he says to himself, am I crazy? An angel comes down and stops this guy from committing, so am I out of my mind?
Exactly.
All right. And he goes home. And fortunately, he turned around and went back. But there it is, you know. It is, and so that really brings me right back to that same point, which is, and we can let the phone ring, it doesn't matter, I'm in their home and their phone is ringing.
Okay.
That it can be so helpful, you know, to have a spouse who's not only exposed to the same insecurities. Okay, I'm going to turn us off now.
And here we did interrupt the interview to succumb to the demands of the telephone. And after Carolyn and Howard spoke on the telephone, I picked the interview back up.
So I know I was saying something about the capacity to comfort each other, because you both know what the other one is going through. But I think the other point that you made about not being young and having survived other relationships and just having life experience really makes a lot of difference to your ability to care for each other.
I'm going to suck in this play.
Yeah.
Okay?
Mm-hmm.
There's no way she's going to suck in the play, even if I haven't seen it. You know, I know that's just her inner fears, because Carolyn is so good and so experienced that she will, you know, find a way to come out with a sparkling performance. But it's the absolute insecurity of the performer. I mean, that's just what it is. So when she says that, it really has nothing to do, I think, with the fact that she does have a lot of experience. She knows she can. She's not in a panic mode.
Mm-hmm.
You know, when you're younger, you get into a panic mode. Oh, my God, what am I going to do? I don't know how to get out of this. I am confident that she knows that she'll get out.
No, you know, when I was younger, I was fearless, and I thought that I was terrific, and anything I did was terrific. So it was really
the other way around.
Now I'm aware of what a complex process it is, and what my own personal demands of myself are in terms of wanting excellence as opposed to good enough. And so it's my own expectation of excellence that promotes me to say, I'm going to suck in this play.
She gets very, very upset with me when, if I'm directing, or even if I went, go to see a preview of a show that I haven't directed, and we're driving home, and she says, you got any notes for me? And I say, No, she gets very upset because I have to have notes for her. She's got to get better. I have to have notes for her.
Wow.
You know, and that's what's going on when I know that she's doing a wonderful job and I don't want to gild the lily. You know, I don't want to mess with it.
So let me ask you here. Do you think that he's telling you the truth when he says, I don't have any notes for you, it's perfect, you don't have to worry about it, you don't have to do anything with it? Do you think he's not telling you the truth?
I think he's not telling me the truth. But I think that, I don't think he's telling me the whole truth. I think that there's probably a couple of things he'd like to tell me, but he feels it's more important for me to have confidence in what I'm
doing.
We're going
to have an argument right now. Because that's not true.
Really?
She has, at times, I have given her good notes. When I have no notes, it means I have no notes.
It's real interesting. I mean, because this is much more about you, I think, than it does about him.
Yes,
you know that you can't even imagine that he doesn't have song notes for you, right?
Right.
Right. And it's the same thing that you were talking about before, which is this, you know, good, better, best, never let it rest until my good is better and my better is the best, and you never get there.
Yeah.
You know? Right.
Well, I've always said that if I ever gave a perfect performance where I was absolutely in the moment and present for every single moment of the play, I would retire, because that's sort of what you aim for, is to be absolutely, you know, present in every single
moment. I don't know how to break
moment.
It to you, but that's schizophrenia.
Oh. Oh, I see. Oh, well, good. So I've achieved it, and it's okay.
Yeah, really.
I look at it another way.
Mm-hmm.
I look at it as it's fleeting, and it's okay. You know, I've just finished doing a piece.
Mm-hmm.
Visiting Mr. Green. I'm going to be doing it again at the Oslo next January. For me, it was, and I've done the play before, twice before. This was the third time.
Mm-hmm.
And for me...
You've directed it. This is the third time you've directed it.
For me, the opening night was perfection.
Wow.
Except for One Blown Like You, for me, the opening night was perfection in terms of the work that the two actors did.
Wow.
And if I say to myself, I've got to recreate that again next time, I will kill myself.
Yes, yes.
I've just got to say, this was the moment. And if it happens again, fine. If it doesn't happen again, it will still be fine.
Yeah, that's so lovely.
It's elusive.
If you could bottle that.
Performance is elusive.
Well, that's of course what makes live performance so exciting, is that it is elusive. And, you know, the film, you can capture that moment and therefore repeat it again and again. They would edit that moment into the piece. Whereas live theater, if you weren't in that audience that night,
you didn't
see that. You will see a wonderful performance. You will see something else. But you'll see the same play and also wonderful, but maybe not that exact chemistry of that particular evening. That's the thrill of live theater and the terror of it as well. But we always must remind ourselves that it is not brain surgery. It is not life and death. It is only facing public humiliation.
It's only a play. Carolyn's favorite statement is about opening night.
Mm-hmm.
All I want to do is escape public humiliation. That's it.
Right. Well, you've been successful so far.
More or less, yes. Knock wood.
She's come out of opening night saying I was not at my best. You know, we all
do that. We all do that. I don't think anybody's really at their best opening nights. Very rarely does that happen unless you've done a play so many times that it's in your bones, and so it's not really an opening night. It's an opening night several productions down the line. Otherwise, I think that there's a lot of adrenaline going on, and there's a lot of, you know, excitement, and you really are better later on in the run when you relax into the play.
We have two previews here. Some theaters,
right,
they only have one preview before opening night. Broadway, they have a month of previews so that they can settle into it and have it right.
Well, and get used to doing it in front of an audience.
Oh, yeah.
Right, the audience is your scene partner. So, yeah, it's sort of cruel and unusual punishment to only have two previews and then to go in front of an audience, especially in a comedy. Death is easy and comedy is hard because of the timing. You have to make real choices and also make choices that are potentially laugh-producing. So it's very tricky. It's a little high-wire balancing act, but all you can do is release yourself to the material and hope that it all, you know, that all the rehearsal turns out okay. And listen for the audience. Connect yourself with what the audience, live audience, tells you so much of where a play lives. And why we perform the plays and don't just read them.
I mean, I just want to say, there's so much more energy over here and so much more calm over here. That's how it feels over here.
That was my job. Not only as a husband, that was my job. You know.
But he's very passionate. He will rant and rail against the gods as well.
Oh, yeah,
so.
I do. I scream and yell.
But what then?
I scream and yell, particularly when I feel a wrong has been done.
Or when I'm
upset because someone I love has a problem and I can't.
You can't solve it.
And yeah. that's a reason for me to do that.
Yeah.
My kids used to say, "Don't get sick, because Dan will be terribly upset." Because you know, I couldn't solve it.
No, but it also makes you a very good compliment for her.
Yeah, we are a compliment for each other.
Yeah, I think it's really clear.
Yeah, she can take adversity much calmer than I can.
Can you?
Yes, I can. I can. I get focused.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, I get very, very focused. So yes, I can be extraordinarily calm. Somebody has to be. So we know when we need.
When
to be
you know what the balance is.
Yeah, when I need to
you
be the calm person, I'm the calm person.
Right.
But essentially an anxious personality, and therefore I have that aura of.
Yeah. It's,
oh my God.
Yeah. Right.
Yeah, that's right.
And you see, now I imagine that it fuels your dedication to your work. Your standards are up so high, and your determination to achieve them is so clear. And the audiences all benefit from that.
Hopefully. Hopefully, yes.
Howard and I talked a little bit about how the two of you have your standards, your morals, your values, your philosophies of life are so...
In sync.
In sync. That's exactly what I was looking for, right. So that's just luck, right? I mean, that's just that you found that in each other.
That is luck, and I don't think we'd be together if it weren't...
Nah. I think it's the Jewish ethic.
The Jewish ethic?
I think it's the Jewish ethic.
Yes.
I do.
So you don't think it's just bashert?
Certainly our coming together is bashert, but our values, I think, comes back to the Jewish ethic.
So it's a shared cultural background.
It's a shared cultural background.
You look at your parents, you look at, you can go right down from parents to grandparents and what have you, even though they were worlds apart, it comes back to that.
It is a shared cultural background, but not all people who share a Jewish cultural background are ethical. I wish they were, but they aren't.
No.
And I think that Howard and I do share a sense of ethics as being very, very, very important.
Yeah. Carolyn and I were talking, I was saying that what was so clear from her was her sense of integrity.
Much more than I have. I'll cut a corner, she won't.
I believe you.
Yeah, I will. I'll cut a corner, but she won't.
I believe
you. Can tell
you.
Her the Neiman Marcus story.
Yeah, I'll tell you the Neiman Marcus
story.
Okay?
Yeah, yeah.
She, her friend sent her an ice cream scooper from Neiman Marcus.
As a gift.
And what arrived were two pieces of luggage worth about $2,000.
Okay. Instead of the ice cream
scooper. Instead of the ice cream scooper.
Okay. Mm-hmm.
And I knew, and she knew, that... We could keep that.
Right. No one would ever...
Ever.
Right.
No, she had to return it. And I said, Carolyn, look, I understand that. But, you know, you have so many events that you donate to that have silent auctions. We hated the luggage. It was ugly. We didn't want to keep it. Donate it to a silent auction.
It was fake animal skin.
Right.
Her friend called her and said, what, are you crazy? Keep it. Donate it. It had to go back.
Yeah,
I would not have sent it back.
No.
That's what I mean.
I understand. I understand.
It had to go back.
Yeah. Hard to be you.
it sucks to be me. Is that the song?
Sucks to be me. That's from Avenue Q.
I know. Everyone's a little bit racist.
Yeah. No, I would have donated it to a charity. You know, mm-hmm. If I hated it that much, I wouldn't have sent it back. I would have just donated it to
Did you get the scooper?
Yeah,
yes, I eventually got the scooper. I did eventually get the scooper. And they gave me, Neiman Marcus gave me a $100 gift card.
Because I gave back
the thousands of dollars worth of luggage. Yeah. So.
And they were stunned.
Yeah. They were stunned.
Even the gal on the phone was stunned.
Yeah. No, I'm
they
sure.
were stunned that I'm I sure. that I was returning it.
Well, all of us are grateful that there are still some people out there.
I think it's important. I think the world's a better place if people can, you know, behave and act with integrity.
When I was a girl, I was walking down the street with my dad in Manhattan, And somebody ran up to him with a tray full of watches and said, cheap watches, you know. And my father said, I'm not buying a watch from you because I know that you stole those watches. And that if I buy this watch from you, that will encourage you to steal. You know, I never forgot that.
Yeah, sure.
You know? And I do think that sort of thing is rare and rarer and rarer and lovely to see wherever you find it. Okay, this has been just delightful for me. Is there anything that either one of you wants to say about yourself as an artist or the couple as an artist or anything at all?
I think we've covered extensive interview.
No, it's been great to spoken with you today.
Great.
And it's wonderful to relive our life in love and art.
Yes.
And I think Howard and I have both been very, very blessed to have lived a life of love and art.
I agree. It's a good place to
start. She's much more articulate than I am.
And that was the articulate and funny and interesting and accessible Carolyn Michael and Howard Millman. And I am so grateful to them for their honesty and intimacy and availability. It is of continual interest to me how people make a living in the arts, how they make a life when their vocation, their work, their job is an art form, and how they balance a relationship, because it's not a secret that regular marriages are falling apart all over the place without the strains and stresses of a life in the arts. And, of course, famously, couples who make their living in the arts are always falling apart. So everything that I hear from these couples, and if you've been listening, then you have heard not only Carolyn and Howard, but Roberta McDonald and Bob Turoff, who are in a 46-year marriage, and Dick Hyman and Julia, his wife Julia, who are in a longer marriage than that, and also Bill Hayes and Susan Seaforth Hayes, who I believe are together 26-27 years. So these people have all figured out how to do it, and I hope that you have enjoyed listening to them, because not only do they have all this information, but they're so interesting and charming and funny. And if you're curious, go to the website and pull up the old podcasts and listen to them there. So now I realize that while I was talking about my website earlier and that you could go up there both to listen to the podcasts and also to vote, I Won't Go With a Whimper is coming up at the end of the show, and please vote and tell me whether you think that I should continue to use it at the end of the show or put it at the beginning of the show. And also, you can get there my book, on which all the information about danger and change and what gets in the way of change can be found. It's a limited edition, but there are still books. So if you're curious and want to read from the horse's mouth, so to speak, you can get it there. The book is called, I think I have forgotten to say in this show, the book is called When You Can, You Will. And there's a little place you can click on and hear me reading from it. Also, there's a workbook that goes with the book, and it has all the exercises that I give here. So you can get that there as well. And you can click on the icon that says, I Won't Go With a Whimper, and it'll take you up to CD Baby. I think I said this before. And you can listen to pieces of others of the songs in case you think a different song would be better for me to use at the beginning and the end of the show. So all that remains to be done now is for me to tell you, as I do every week, about Josh Hackney, who is my IT guy, and who I really couldn't do without. And if you hear the clicking of my computer, that's because I'm looking up his information so that I can give it to you. His telephone number is 941-320-7590, and you can email him at joshchackney@yahoo.com. And as I am fond of saying in every show, there is nothing about electronics, computers, internet, recording, telephones, you name it, Josh knows about it. So if you have any problems with any of this kind of thing and you actually want help, call Josh or go up on my website and click the Contact Me button and say, I want Josh, and I'll get him for you. Okay, I think that's it. I think that's all I have to say in the show. Well, of course, that's absurd. I have so much more to say. I didn't finish talking about how feelings are a past danger, but I will pick that up next week. And so, for now, I'm just going to say, this is The Lynn Show. I will be back next week at the same time, which is Tuesday at 1 o'clock Eastern Standard Time, unless you're listening in Europe, or as I'm fond of saying, you're a jazz musician, then you can hear the show on Mondays at 3 a.m. I'll be back then. And I sure hope you will be too.
You see, I'm getting older. My hair is turning gray. Oh, you say my face and figure have both seen better days. Well, I won't be retiring. I won't slip out of sight. No, I will not go gentle into that good night. I won't go with a whimper. I am going with a bang. Life's a song I keep on singing, not a tune that I once sang. I just keep returning like some goddamn boomerang. No, I won't go with a whimper. I am going with a bang. You see that I have had my shot. My time has come and gone. Oh, won't I please get off the stage? Let someone else get on. Will I won't be relegated or leave without a fight. No, I will not go gentle into that good night. I won't go with a whimper. I am going with a bang. Life's a bell I keep on ringing, not a chime that I once rang. You may think it's unseemly. Well, I don't give a dang. No, I won't go with a whimper. I am going with a bang. Rising from the ashes every chance I get. I may be running out of time, but it ain't over yet. 'Cause me and Sister Phoenix, we won't give up the flight. No, no, we will not go gentle into that good night. And I won't go with a whimper. I'm going with a bang. Life's a song I keep on singing, not a tune that I once sang. I may not be as juicy, hell, but I still got some tang. So you won't hear me simper. I may have gotten limper, but I won't